Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to The Fandom Files, a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachrin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudette, who hates burps but loves farts. Emily, what's up?
What's up, man? That was the weirdest intro I've ever gotten.
We were just talking about that before we went on air.
No, we weren't. I'm just kidding. Yes.
Yes, we were.
Yes, and...
Yeah,
oh, we have something else to talk about.
You're improving me. Anyways, Emily, you think burps are gross because they shouldn't be coming out of people's mouths.
Yeah, it's against the natural order. It's like when you throw up, your body knows what to do, but you have this sense of like, oh, this shouldn't be happening.
So when you fart, you're like, that felt right.
Yes.
Cool.
Do you not?
No, yeah. I do. I say, that was me because I felt right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyways, I demand applause. Other than this conversation, Emily, what is the geekiest thing you did this week?
Gross. I rewatched Thor Ragnarok, and I noticed a little moment that I hadn't noticed before. And then when I went to the internet to check it out, there was like hundreds of fan art pieces about it. It was like this whole thing that people had discussed, and I missed.
What is the moment?
So there's a moment where Thor initially meets Grandmaster, and Loki is like, I've been here for weeks. And Thor's like, well, what do you mean? How did you curry the Grandmaster's favor? And Jeff Goldblum winks at Tom Hiddleston, and Tom Hiddleston makes this look like, don't do that. And Thor goes, his eyes go back and forth between the two of them, and he's like, wait. And then the conversation goes on. And I was like, huh. That was, and then I realized, at the end, when they get away in the ship, Loki knows the code to that ship, and then that ship turns out to be Goldblum's orgy craft.
Oh.
So, like, Loki, who is very sexual, as you know that I know, it makes perfect sense with his character that he would, like, seduce Grandmaster or allow himself to be some kind of sub.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that insinuates that the Grandmaster is also into... that. Are we just
well, the Grandmaster's a celestial, and when Thor shows up, he asks, it's a he, right? Like, he doesn't understand, or gender just doesn't matter. The way that Groot doesn't notice gender.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
And there was, like, a lot of people were talking about that.
Oh, yeah, I looked it up. I was like, Loki, Grandmaster, W, and it was like, wink, gif, fan fiction. Like,
oh,
people love it, and I found doctored gifs that look really seductive. They look like it could have happened in the movie. But it didn't.
Of what?
Let me just show you one where, like, Jeff Goldblum is, like, aggressively making a move on.
Oh, boy,
Loki.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so someone doctored that just for that 1 second of footage?
Yeah. Oh, that's very Tumblr.
Yeah, wow.
But anyway, what was the geekiest thing you did, and was it less steamy?
Well, I also did something with Marvel, and thank God it was less steamy. I went to the... Nassau Coliseum, which growing up in New York area my entire life, I'd never been to the Nassau Coliseum before.
Never heard of it.
It's like an arena in Long Island where the Islanders used to play. And
you
we'll
wanted
play again.
To go when you were little?
No, I never wanted to go. No, I didn't go for a reason.
Okay.
It's trash. Anyways, but I'm doing a story, or I did a story, on Marvel Universe Live, which is like the traveling road show that is kind of like circusy / Disney on Ice, but it's like an action show with Marvel characters, and they have basically this long plot that's kind of set in the Age of Ultron period, but like, because they don't use the MCU, they have like Guardians of the Galaxy meets the Avengers and Spider-Man's in it, and so no legal rights they have to worry about, even though it is licensed by Marvel. And it was really insane. I'll put up the story about it with this podcast, and it was really funny. There was like combat fighting, there was motorcycles, there was pyrotechnics, but we had really good seats because they were comped, and so you could just see that they weren't punching each other. Also, like, I had watched the rehearsal, so I knew kind of what they were doing.
Oh.
So I was doing the story. And so it was just really, really campy. But I feel like a lot of little kids, this is their introduction to superheroes in a way.
Yeah.
Other than like cartoons, and they were like thrilled.
Sure.
And I'm not going to say you're stupid little kids or anything, but Julie and I were the only childless adults there.
Yeah.
And we felt weird.
In the video you sent me, I loved that Rocket was like human-sized.
Oh, it was so weird.
It was just Rocket, a guy in a suit.
Yeah, they were like, Groot's not that tall. I mean, he's taller because he's on stilts.
Yeah.
But like, he's like a shrub.
Right.
Like a big, like a nice, like a palm tree sized.
Sure.
And Rocket is like the size of like a 15-year-old kid who hasn't had his growth spurt yet.
Like, if that was true in the movies, that would be a completely different character.
That dynamic would be so different.
Yeah, because he would be up for possible mating with human female characters.
That's exactly where your mind goes?
Yes.
It immediately goes to the sex?
Yes, because he's not flirty at all, but, you know, it's Bradley Cooper, like he would be in a different role.
I was just going to say that he might not have the same chip on his shoulder.
Oh, yeah, if he could just physically eat people.
I was going to say, like, hit them. And fight in a different way.
I was thinking seduce, whatever.
Well, you were the one who just read Loki. Goldblum fan fiction. Also, there was the one outrageous thing there. They were bringing around snow cones and these like character head cups.
Cool.
$15.
Oh, yeah.
It was sick.
That's really sad because if you bring a kid,
right,
that you've already paid the price to get in, and I'm sure mm-hmm. for many families that's, you know, annoying to nearly impossible, then you just have to say no all night.
Right.
Yeah.
And like this kid like got like, he got, I mean, they got like, this one kid in front of us got like a Spider-Man toy and I think he got like a pretzel at some point. Like his parents were, you know, doing him right.
Yeah.
But he was, you can't give them everything. A, because it's like a lesson in life, I suppose. And then also just financially, it's unsustainable.
Right. Because you spend an extra $200 when you're at the thing.
We felt really guilty because we walked in there and we had good seats because I'm writing a story about it. But there was like families who were in like the upper deck and I wanted to be like, take our tickets.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't. Because I felt, but I did feel guilty. I felt strange, like being down there and like goofing off. But I guess anything for press, right?
That's your motto.
That's my motto. I'll do anything for attention. The Jordan Zacharin story.
It's all content.
Yep. Joining us this week is like honestly the perfect guest for the Fandom Files. Glenn Weldon is a journalist, author, major geek, and expert on fandom. He's written the book Cape Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, which is a book I love, and Superman, the Unauthorized Biography. He's also a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Glenn, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I knew your Batman book when I started writing about comic books. That was like part of the basic syllabus that every reporter needed to read.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Well,
yeah.
That's great to hear. I mean, it's only a couple years old, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Emily's a newbie.
Yeah, great. I haven't been writing very long.
Okay, cool.
But
you know, it is, I mean, because it's not just about Batman, it's about, again, it's even in the title, The Rise mm-hmm. of Nerd Culture, which I think is a very worthy topic of exploration in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love talking about ourselves, don't we?
Yeah. I
always think
film critics' favorite thing to write about is film criticism. And I guess the same thing with nerds.
True.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the rise of your nerd story. That's a weird way to say it. What is your geek? Or let's talk about how did you become a geek when you were a kid?
Because we couldn't do sports. I mean, that's, you know, you've probably heard that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I've said often that sports is just kind of culturally accepted nerdism. I mean, you know, what are box scores? Box scores are the nerdiest things out there. They're just numbers. And people have this, they come conversant with all this really arcane information about the history of the players that they love. And what is, you know, dressing up in a jersey and going to a game? It's cosplay.
Mm.
I just got attracted to, in my case, superheroes is where it all started out. And it wasn't from comics originally. I think a lot of people in my generation share the fact that we were turned on to superheroes through television, through reruns of the old Super Friends cartoon or for reruns of the old Batman 66 television series. And the first time I tried comics, they didn't take because I liked the simplicity of the, you know, Spider-Man cartoons and the Batman television show. And at the time when I was trying to pivot away from television into comics, comics were going through a time of reaching for relevance. And and they were also, like, I remember my first comic was a Legion of Superheroes comic where they were going back and forth and trying to elect a treasurer and whining about their boyfriends and their girlfriends. And I was like, nope, no thank you. Because at the time, comics were reaching for an older audience of teens and young adults. And I was a kid. And they just didn't seem for me. But, I, you know, eventually I got the bug.
They still are kind of confusing compared to movies, like different, especially now with DC and Marvel constantly rebooting themselves in some way or another, these big series.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think what separates a nerd from a normal is when somebody picks up a comic and sees, you know, as highlighted in issue 312, and you just feel like there's this enormous chasm opening up with all this information for you to know. And some people get that feeling and shut down. They're like, nope. But a lot of us see that as like a challenge. And there is the collector mindset of just the acquisitiveness of it. But, you know, I do wonder how that feeling functions now in the age of Wikipedia. Because all the stuff that I used to have to do, the information you used to talk about in the backs of comic shops is now right at your fingertips. And, you know, I mean, one of the things I wanted to make sure I wasn't doing with these books was just writing a $75,000 Wikipedia entry.
Right.
And that's the challenge of any kind of long project like that.
You know, now that I think about it, when I was a kid, I got really into Spider-Man, and this was during sort of the Ben Reilly era when he had a clone who took on Spider-Man. And And I think the fact that I just couldn't look it up on Wikipedia, maybe I like the problem I have with comics now, and I still read them, you know, recreationally on you know, when I can get to the comic store, download stuff on an app. But there's just so much to know, and it's all available. When I was a kid, I couldn't know it all, so I just enjoyed the story as it was coming. You know, I couldn't be such a completionist collector.
Yeah, and I think it changes our attitude toward this information. I mean, there is this, in nerd culture, there is this toxicity. There is this, you're not a true nerd, you're a fake geek girl, all that kind of crap, that comes from the availability of this information. It's easy to get it. So, you know, people... You know, Patton Oswalt has talked about this many times, where it's like, I had to work for this information and you can get it easily. There's a really toxic resentment that is, you know, I mean, it's part of the culture, and online it can get very, very loud. But I think when we were all together trying to share this information with each other, just when we would see each other, all those very rare times nerds would get together at a comic shop or at a con, it's different. I think ultimately, it means that all this whole rich history is more available, and, you know, information being more available is a net good, that it always will be. But there are some people who see this, you know, as I mentioned in the book, there's some people who see a story like this or a superhero history like this, and they want to treat it like it's a hotel pool. They get in, they do their laps, they can see the bottom, and they get out. You know, just tell me a story. And there are some people like me who kind of wants to see this as the sea, as the ocean. And you go in there and you can't see the bottom. And it's a place you just hang out in. And you know, there's some toxic, nasty things in there. But you know, if you don't bother them, they might not bother you.
God, that's beautiful.
That's
I love that. Yeah,
Emily, your dad's a big Batman fan, right?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up going to comic shops because that was like my time with my dad. And I remember like I needed a reason to go. I was like, oh, I'm going to go. And I saw he would always pick up whatever. He was collecting like new editions of Frank Miller.
Yeah.
And I remember scanning the wall. It was a wall of comics in the mall. And there was Batgirl. It was Cassandra Cain at the time. And I was like, oh, this is the equivalent for me. So I jumped in like mid-arc. I remember you didn't know who any of the characters were. But there was, I'm glad you said collector's mindset, because I was able to say to my dad, like, hey, Dad, I have 63, 65, and 68. And he was like, well, that won't do. We have to go get the other ones. But yeah, there was this aspect of you're almost putting together a puzzle. And then if there's a reference to something else, I was like, oh, okay, I guess next time we go, I'll have to get Huntress and Spoiler, you know.
Let me ask you a question though, because you know, my parents were, my dad was a jock, my mom was a cheerleader, and when I kind of found, and you know, there might be some element of rejecting that sportsy sports mindset that they had, I always wondered what would happen if my parents were nerds. My colleague on the show, Stephen Thompson, his mother is, of course, Maggie Thompson, who's Comic Buyer's Guide, Comic Buyer's Guide, just a huge nerd historian. And he pretty much rejected that and went and became a geek about music. So did you ever feel like you wanted to go your own path and find something else, or was it something about the bonding with your pop?
That's a great question. I think he inadvertently, or maybe he did this on purpose, he would give me comics and then say like, oh, but this one's off limits. It's not, you're not old enough to read this. So he had like cool, he was into like punk comics too. I forget what line it was, but it was like I've gone back to them as an adult and I was like, this is horrific what you were reading. It was called Beautiful Stories for Ugly Children. And it's just very, very dark, dark. But anyway, as a kid, I remember thinking like, if I read enough of these, my dad's going to like allow me access to the cool adult comics. I was like 10. I mean, maybe 13, from 10 to 13.
Yeah.
But anyway,
right.
It's an ocean, like you said. And I eventually found characters that he had never heard of. His Batman is a solitary guy. My Batman is like a father figure to 12.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the great thing about the character is that he cycles through different iterations. And there can be different versions of him for different folks. You know, he goes from being the light, dark Avenger of the Night, the loner, to being a patriarchal figure, to being a mentor. And they're both equally important aspects of his character. And there is a tendency among a small but very vociferous section of the fandom to say this version of Batman is the only true version, and anything that rubs up against it is wrong. And there is a there's a homophobic aspect to that particular aspect of the fandom. There's a misogynistic aspect to the fandom. That's the fact that these characters are just heavily licensed nuggets of intellectual property means that they have to be made available to everybody. Every artist and every writer who comes along takes this thing out of the tool chest and plays with it for a while and then puts it back. And the law of IP means that you can't damage it. You can't fundamentally change it, because the nature of comic book storytelling, serialized storytelling, is cyclical. The Joker has to get away because you need something to do next month. That means that you are denying these characters the thing that makes a story, which is an ending. There is that very satisfying, the Freytag's Pyramid, the rising action, falling action, denouement, that's hugely important. And we can, in comics and in superhero storytelling, we can have versions of that, but we can't have that kind of finality, which is why when people do, when somebody like Frank Miller comes along and says, I'm going to tell the ending of this story, the cyclical story that's been going on for decades, this seems removed from what's gone before. It feels fundamentally different. And it's also why, nerds like it, but normals like it too, because they just want to say, yeah, give me the high points. Just tell me a story and make sure it has an ending.
Right.
You know, I know you said in your book, and you just mentioned here, like your version of Batman, if there's, you have your own version, it's kind of the 60s TV version. But every time Batman gets too campy, people rebel and want him back to be that solitary figure, even though, as you mentioned in your book, it's also an aspirational thing instead of just being relatability.
Absolutely. But if it wasn't for the Adam West Batman, we would never have gotten the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams Batman, which many people think is the definitive version, right? Because that was a reaction to the campy Batman. I mean, this is the cyclical nature of the character. Like, that became... The Adam West Batman became hugely popular. That's one thing, such that the nerds of the time were feeling resentful that the mainstream was liking something, was loving something that they loved, but not in the right way. At the end of the day, people like Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams were fans as much as they were writers. I mean, they were part of that new generation of people coming into comics who had grown up with these characters and loved them, as opposed to people from the earlier eras who were just cranking it out because they happened not to be, writing ad copy. It was a job to them. And for people of the Aladdin generation, it was a passion. So he cared very deeply that this character be treated, taken seriously, which, of course, leads us to all kinds of dark, unpleasant places. But if Adam West hadn't come along and been the cultural phenomenon he was, you know, they were often threatening, DC was often threatening to cancel the Batman title because of low sales. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was ever a legitimate threat, because it's just, you don't throw away even a, you know, even a poorly performing piece of intellectual property that's been, you know, giving you money for decades, you just don't throw it away. But who knows what the character would look like now if Denny O'Neill hadn't, you know, hadn't rebooted him fundamentally.
You know, it's funny, we see it with Star Wars also, because now the filmmakers who are making Star Wars, it's the first generation of people who grew up with Star Wars, as opposed to, you know, all the movies made by George Lucas. And so, you know, they take it, I wouldn't say more seriously, but it has a different flavor on it, because, like, in a way, they're carbon copies, or, like, say, you know, it's like a, you know, they've saved it. There's a version that's been, like, rebooted slightly. It's like an alternate universe version. So when you see, like, Batman and Superman after the first generation of writers, it's almost entirely different character, even if it looks exactly the same.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there are aspects of the character that don't change, but everything else can. And you're absolutely right. The Star Wars is a good comparison, because there is something about, and I'm trying to write about this now, there is something about the nostalgia we feel for a given property, which is toxic, you know, because it means you're looking backwards as opposed to looking forward. Mm. But I think the stuff we love, generally speaking, is the stuff that we chose. Like, the period of, late childhood, early adolescence is a time of trying to define who you are. And one of the ways you do that is by defining first what you're not, what you don't like. You know, what my parents, I am not my parents, I am not my brothers, I am not my friends. I like this thing that they don't, or I like this thing in a way that they don't. And I think certain things, like for me, Star Wars and certainly Batman, were things that were hugely, you know, culturally omnipresent, but I appreciated them and, you know, would spend hours and hours reading about and thinking about them in ways that maybe other people didn't. And I think that's why when I see people, when Ryan Johnson toys with the mythology and throws things at him, I'm like, yes, sure, because this has to happen. It's like, otherwise we're just telling the same story over and over again. There has to be growth. There has to be movement, or else what are you even doing?
Well, and it's interesting that, so you mentioned Ryan Johnson, there is that he's really changing it fundamentally. It felt like sort of the Zack Snyder was sort of catering to this really masculine, gritty version that people idealized. But just starting with Ryan Johnson, his decisions on Luke Skywalker, which, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Star Wars yet, fan, people listening to this, like, I'm going to spoil it for you. With Luke Skywalker, dying the way he did, people were saying, like, you're using the hashtag not my Luke, right? People were really upset about that because it wasn't the version they remembered and they didn't want anything to change.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about nerd culture, is that it is inherently reactive and reactionary. It prizes a thing from your childhood that you don't necessarily want to see change. And yet, to tell a story, there has to be growth, there has to be movement, there has to be starting out someplace and going somewhere else. And so the other good thing about nerd culture is that stuff's always still going to be there. If you want to go back and watch Star Wars again, go nuts. This is the thing that I have had to talk a couple people down about about Star Wars myself. And I basically said, look, your Luke is still your Luke. He's fine. Mm-hmm. But what happens when we allow more people of color, when we allow women to kind of take a leading role? What we're doing is we're taking something that was monolithic and we're making it less so. Anytime you make something less monolithic, less generic and all things to all people, you are making it interesting. You are finding new stories to tell. And to do that in a universe like this, which is theoretically as vast as it can be, is just a net good.
What do you make of the current situation that DC finds itself in with those movies, other than Wonder Woman, having had the Snyderverse, could you call it? I guess, I don't know, what do you ever call it?
Yeah.
What do you make of that? It felt like they were trying to cater to something that ended up being a very strong fan view, but a minority of fans.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I understand where it came from. It came from the fact that the Dark Knight films were very popular and critically successful, and they thought to themselves, we understand how to do these superhero films now. They have to be grim, dark, things of sacrifice and morally complicated, or at least as morally complicated as Zack Snyder can get. And and what that fails to acknowledge is that you can't tell a Superman story with using the same tone and the same approach that you would a Batman story. They're fundamentally different characters. Yes. They have different. They vibrate on different frequencies. Mm-hmm. So this is something that Marvel knew from the jump. I mean, there's a Thor movie and there's an Ant-Man movie, and they don't feel the same way. Now, well, actually, Ragnarok feels more like Ant-Man than the previous Thor movies did. But it's so good. But that means you can mix it up. Once you establish the character and the sort of gravitas of the character, then you can play with it.
Right.
You can't just throw everybody up on the screen at the same time and say, now we're going to differentiate these characters. I mean, yes, the way you delineate characters is by putting them in conflict with each other. And that's certainly a very old nerdy thing to do, to say this hero fights this hero because this hero can kick this hero's butt. That's just a nerdy conversation, but there has to be some motivating factor mm-hmm. in it. And, you know, in a Superman film, you want to, at some point, you want to cheer, right? You want to be uplifted, not depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come out of pretty much every Superman film just feeling, you know, like they missed the mark, that because they're investing him with all this, he doesn't smile.
Right.
He just needs to smile. That's who he is.
He was like too human, where he's not supposed to be human in a way.
Yeah. I mean, they played with it in that opening shot of Justice League, where, you know, he's talking to kids and he's smiling, and I thought to myself, okay, they finally understand that, you know, who this character is and what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and anybody who says you can't tell a compelling story about Superman because he can do anything is kind of fundamentally misunderstanding the character, because what he wants to do is impossible. What he wants to do is save everybody. And you complicate his life. You give him an interesting conflict by showing that he can do anything in the universe, and still he can't do the one thing he wants to do. That's a conflict that that some of the best superhero stories, Superman stories, have ever been built on,
mm-hmm.
because these characters are, you know, children's characters. They are meant to teach very tidy moral lessons, and we can complicate them and try to make them as grim and gritty as we want. But at the end of the day, they're cool-looking people who can do stuff. They are aspirational. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to write about this, but so much of these characters are purely the visual component, the mix of colors, mm-hmm. the look of the cape, the look, because it's comics are comics, right? Comics are 50% image.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they live in the tension or the synergy among text and image. And so many times, like, you know, I find myself thinking, I really love this character, but when I go to read a story about him or her, that power isn't there because they're going through the typical, you know, story conventions. And you know, I might not be drawn to the story, but I'll always be drawn to the character because I think there's something primal in just the look. I think that's why, in the 70s, when they finally got wised up and learned that they could just turn these characters into logos, essentially, and just people would slap them up on their walls because they just like looking at them. That's not to take away anything from a really good story. I just think that these characters have a primal power among the, you know, specific subset of the audience that they do because of that appeal of the visuals.
So what do you think it is that differentiates like a character that people, why did people start loving Superman or Batman or Spider-Man versus characters that look very similar?
Well, characters who enter the cultural like mindset, the zeitgeist, are usually driven there by some kind of mass market, mass communications tool. Like, you know, comics, even at their height, were selling 500,000, maybe a million, like, you know, and that's a lot, but if you get this character on television, you get this character on a movie screen, suddenly you're talking about millions and billions of people worldwide mm-hmm. who are being exposed to them. Familiarity breeds contempt, yes, but it also breeds the opposite of contempt, which is love. And I think people like the Spider-Man theme song, people like the Superman fanfare, people like the way Christopher Reeve filled out some tights. there's something about the primacy, the simplicity of these characters that appeals. That said, there's going to be people who like Spawn or, you know, some real dark, gritty character because they're 14-year-old boys and that's what 14-year-old boys like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the end of the day, superheroes are about superlatives, like Superman is the strongest and Wonder Woman is the bravest and Batman is the smartest and Spider-Man is the cleverest. And that appeals to our inner kid, our desire to see ourselves in a friendlier light, a kinder light, to compare ourselves to them,
mm-hmm.
and find ourselves sort of existing in the same space.
You know, it's funny. On Saturday, I went to this thing called Marvel Universe Live, and like, you know, Disney on Ice. Basically, it's kind of that, but for superheroes. And I went for I'm writing a story on the whole road production of it. And so I figured I should see mm-hmm. the actual show. And my girlfriend and I were definitely the only childless adults there. But, we were at Nassau Coliseum. And what was funny to me is I was watching seeing kids around me. There's all these superheroes running around. And the story was certainly not very deep. Mm-hmm. You know, they were doing these like, mm-hmm. you know, ridiculous, funny, silly stunts. And we got a kick out of it because it was just so campy. But a lot of the times the kids weren't, I mean, they were watching, but a lot of times they're just playing with the toys that they had bought there and
what,
not actually
really?
Watching. Yeah. And so you realize like they were thrilled, I'm sure, to see, you know, Spider-Man when they looked up from playing with their Spider-Man toy, which might have been trippy for like a 4-year-old.
Mm.
But it was definitely something more primal than just like story. You know, like what colorful thing catches their eye in a way.
Huh. That makes sense.
It does. It's costumes, it's spectacle, it's splash pages, it's, for me, it's something as simple as seeing like the Avengers or the Justice League roll call, you know, that row of heads on a comic book page that takes me back to a time of just that, because that or whenever they're putting together a new Justice League and they have the headshots on the table. There's something about that very simple, these tropes that keep coming back that there is a pre-verbal appeal.
Mm.
But at the same time, you know, it's what? You know, Batman is sort of a rogue. He's a rich guy who breaks the laws and, you know, to enforce laws, but to do what he wants. And I know you've called like Superman sort of a New Deal Democrat because he came out during that time and was very aspirational in a way. And so there is that political angle to them. Do you think, I've always wondered, do you think superheroes are inherently conservative archetypes just because they are special figures that do what they want and break the laws?
Well, I've written about this. There is an element of fascism to the superhero imagery because you've got idealized bodies and the notion of might making right, of some individual person, you know, a extra legal agent of benign intervention, right?
That's why Red Sun was so good. Sorry to interrupt.
No, absolutely. He keyed into something there. It's right there. It's right there underneath the surface. It's not necessarily, you know, they went out of their way in the 70s, because it was the 70s, to show Batman starting up the Wayne Foundation and helping, you know, victims of crime. And that's a very sort of nice, liberal, woolly-headed kind of approach. Because, you know, what does he do at night? He punches folk. he punches crime right in the face.
Mentally ill villains.
Right, exactly. And he is ultimately punishing criminals for trying to steal some lady's purse as opposed to protecting. You get the notion that Superman is trying to protect and Batman is trying to punish.
Mm.
And that's again, anybody taking the law in their own hands is an inherently fascist notion, or at least it's a deeply troubling one. But that's why in the 90s, especially, which I consider a benighted time in comics, when the visuals got pushed to the max. So you would collect these comics of just nothing but 32 splash pages in a row of just brutal violence and people with guns and maces and katanas, you know, sticking out of their the backpacks. And because, again, pure visuals, that's when the story went away and the visuals became everything.
Mm.
Like, that's a time when you know, it's all cotton candy and there's no substance there.
Well, they had like thighs the size of like grapefruits. Like they were like so,
Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, they were just like so jacked too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so their little tiny heads were perched in these just mountains of flesh. because that's it. They were like, okay, so if we want people to collect this, we're going to turn each page into a piece of pop art. And we're going to kind of like dial down this notion that we have to tell credible stories.
And I'm wondering what you think. And obviously, these superheroes, in a way, reflect their times, right? Like Batman reflects the age of aspirations to wealth because people were poor, and Superman is certainly aspirational. And you know, different heroes represent different times. But I'm wondering, how do you think, if at all, superheroes and fiction like that have impacted the culture and the cultural perception? Do you think we're okay with like police violence because Batman just does whatever the fuck he wants?
I think there's some readers who would see that. I think most readers probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
They are reflective of the times. The more popular they get, I guess. I mean, like basically, we are now living in a glut of superhero media. A time that I never thought would happen. growing up, I thought, okay, we're going to get a Superman movie, and then that'll be it. but I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy, nobody saw that coming.
Right?
Ant-Man, there's an Ant-Man movie. But now, you know, this is when I talked to people for the book, I talked to a lot of different people who, and the creators were always saying, look, the reason this is happening now is because finally movie special effects have caught up. And now there is not this barrier to entry that comic, there's no stigma attached to comics because people don't need to go to comics. They can go to the movies and get these wonderful stories, these wonderful characters that creators like me have been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to several people who said, no, it's exactly what you said, Emily. It's because this is what my family is. My family are nerds and this is the thing we do together. And the people who made started out kind of doing blogs or message boards are basically like, the internet is what changed everything. The internet means that I had this thing that I loved, that I was alone in my high school, that I was alone in my college, loving it. But now I am in contact with, you know, hundreds of, if not thousands of people across the world who share this love. And so I don't feel alone. So I don't know how superheroes are kind of changing the culture, but I do know that the superhero is now its own independent genre, and that means it's going to cycle in and out of fashion, which means, you know, because Westerns came and went, gangster films came and went,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they come back, but we are now living in the time, this is like the gangster films in the 30s and the Westerns in the 50s. This is the era we're living in now. And ultimately the wheel's going to turn again because it always has to. So even though people are a lot of people, especially people in and around NPR are sort of like, oh, well, Glenn, can you take the superhero film? Cause I'm just so tired. They should, you know, take heart. I mean, ultimately we're going to hit the bottom of this well, and the fact that Spider-Man has gotten rebooted twice in 9 years is a symbol that this is not completely inexhaustible, and that yes, in some form, this genre is going to be around forever, but it is one of the newest genres out there in terms of mainstream movies, and it's inevitably going to stranglehold on the international box office is gonna loosen at some point.
What's funny is I can certainly remember a time before this, obviously before Iron Man, I guess, is what really, or I guess the Batman Begins really kicked it off. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can certainly remember a time before that, but it's hard for me, not that I don't believe you, I certainly believe you, but to envision a life without this just permeating everything, superhero movies and TV shows.
Yeah, they're gonna adapt or die because that's the only thing that can happen. We can't tell the Avengers again because we already told it.
Mm-hmm.
We can't tell the Superman's origin story. We certainly should not be telling Batman's origin story anytime again.
Mm-mm.
Because leave poor Martha went alone because that woman has suffered enough.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, the DC movies, all the ones they have on the slate in like pre-development are Gotham family. They're all like Batman's affiliates, which I feel equal part like anxiety because I feel personally connected to these Gothamites, but also kind of excitement because that has to force the movies to change their tone.
Yeah, you'd think so. I certainly hope so. I really want them to understand that like the Nightwing approaches everything very differently than Batman does, and that's that's important. And if we get a Batgirl movie and they don't screw it up, that would be just wonderful.
I know.
Although, are you guys watching Gotham?
I started. I fell off like a few seasons in, I think.
Yeah, me too. I don't think I quite lasted even the first season because, you know, it's a Batman show without Batman. What do I want from that? Have you guys started Krypton yet?
Yeah, it's a sci-fi show. I think I'm contractually obligated to watch it.
Okay, good.
But I actually do enjoy it.
I'm actually surprised because I thought it was going to be the same thing. It's like, okay, so Superman show without Superman, Batman show without Batman. We're going to get a Wonder Woman that's about like a lump of clay. But it looks great.
Yeah.
You can't say it doesn't look great. And they certainly know, I've only seen the first couple, but they certainly know how to make a story start. And you know, it's, I don't know what they're going to do with all these characters once they have them in the mix, but it's more promising than I was expecting.
Yeah, I was worried. I mean, you know, I guess I was sort of worried that it was going to be too serious, you know, because it has a great look to it, but I was concerned, you know, this was going to be like, this is about your legacy, this is about your grandson and all that, but it's actually a lot of fun so
far. That's why I like the buddy. When the bartender buddy showed up, I was like, oh, okay, so they knew that they needed some comic relief. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
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 That's what's been the pleasant surprise.
He's really good. And yes, we get dead parents because it's superheroes and that's the law.
Sure.
But, that guy, Kim, the guy who plays Kim is a lot of fun. They're even letting the main character have a little bit of humor, which is not something that these shows tend to do. That's a smart thing. Mm-hmm. And even the guy who plays Adam Strange is fun too. So yeah, I'm encouraged by it. It's not the direction I necessarily want to see a lot of these shows go. I don't care about. I don't want to see a Flash show. It's about a shelf of chemicals and a lightning storm. But I like it.
Well, what it's nice is that it's not really limited by canon in a way because we haven't really seen much about Krypton throughout. I mean, there's been stuff about Krypton throughout Superman's story, but no one's that devoted to, I think, any of the origin stories. Yeah,
yeah.
And so you can kind of, as much as you're limited by the fact that the planet has to blow up at some point. You can, until that point, there's a lot of freedom, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly why they do it, right? Because you have, all these characters are cordoned off. You can't touch this character, you can't touch that character because the movies are doing X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to play, if you want the status of being in this universe, but being free to tell stories, your own stories, that's exactly what you do. I'm not necessarily waiting around for all kinds of cute little shout-outs to the actual canon.
Right.
I'm willing to let them kind of play out and do their thing off in that little corner of the DC universe.
You know what just came to me? A show about Aunt May and Uncle Ben's early romance in like the Depression era.
Oh my God.
I'm sure the CW is probably already on that noise.
Get at me. I'm willing to write that pilot if anyone wants to contract me to do that. I mean, come on, it's like a Depression era type thing. They're very good people, you know.
And there's just no mention of superpowers at all.
No.
It's just a period piece about the Depression.
Like Ben keeps getting bitten by spiders and he's like, God, why am I just obsessed with being bitten by spiders, but nothing ever happens to him. Like, he's just like, I'm getting swollen again.
That's pretty dumb.
Yeah, it's pretty dumb. You just call it great responsibility. And yep.
There you go. Oh. That's the thing. He has to learn with great power comes great responsibility.
That's right. What Ben has to learn. It's the origin of that statement.
Yeah, it's the origin story for a phrase.
That's so smart.
Yeah. Let's write this together.
One of the things when I was researching the Superman book, I discovered is that in the original Superman serial, Pa Kent says to, I think it's, it might not be Kirk Allen, it might be Kirk Allen, or the kid playing a young Clark. This is back in 1941.
Wow.
He says, you know, when you have enormous powers like yours, they come with great responsibility. And what? I was like, I know.
Oh
like,
my
like
God.
That's my contribution to superhero scholarship right there is.
Well, it's like you said in your book, like everything's a ripoff. Like Batman was just such a ripoff of the Shadow and like literally tracing, you know, like the characters.
Oh, yeah, dude. Bob Kane was shameless. And, you know, it's but I mean, this is the thing. What is creativity but putting things together in ways that they haven't been put together before? You just take two things that are out there and you combine them and that's how it works.
Now, I'm curious what you, we talked about all the different versions of Batman. I know you are, you know, an Adam West guy. What do you think of Ben Affleck's Batman? Because there's been a lot of debate around that. Like, the movies are bad, but he's good. What do you think of him?
He's got the chin, which is, you know, for Batman, that's going to get you, it's going to get you like 30%, 40% down the road, mm-hmm. I think, because that is the only thing you see of the character. The only human aspect of him really is the chin. I don't think he's the best actor in the world, and I don't think he's giving a lot. And, you know, he is doing a ripoff of the Christian Bale rasp, which is, you forget how weird that choice is.
Yes.
Because when you hear on the animated series, which I think is probably the best version of a character that's ever going to be committed to screen.
Agreed.
Because it's such a synthesis of everything that makes the character good, put into this format that is easily digestible for normals. Like,
yeah.
So nerds love it because it's reverent, but it's not too reverent, and normals like it because it's easily digestible. When you hear Kevin Conroy just kind of tossing off his Batman voice by knocking it down a couple octaves, and you think, okay, well, that works. That works perfectly well. And then you hear what Christian Bale is doing, and you're like, what the hell is that? So he's doing a version of that. I mean, I think he looks good in the costume. I like that in Justice League he gets a chance to be a little bit, not glib, but just to have a little bit of animation, and he's not just this humorless clod he was in Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
And anytime we allow a little bit of light into the character, we delineate him better. We make him make him something besides this fantasy of 14-year-old boys across the world. You know, we're just I'll beat up that kid who took my lunch money. You know, he will never do that to me again. Like, that's what you get from the when you take Batman too seriously.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, just revenge and full. It's funny, like it's. The one I took Christian Bale's like growl is that he seemed like, as much as he was cocky, he seemed sort of still insecure to me, and his growl was a way of like projecting, hey, look, I'm tougher than I think I am inside.
No, that makes sense, but the thing is, like, he also did it like, and I think the cowl was pinching his nose, so he just sounded like he had a bad cold, and that's scary, viruses, you know.
Yeah. If I don't beat you up, I'm going to slowly break you down with you, with my illness.
That's right.
Yeah. I won't give you the bat serum.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask you one thing. I'm a big fan of Comedy Bang Bang, and you mentioned in the book early on, I think it is, you talked to Scott Aukerman about why people of a certain age are really the original geeks. And he mentions that you were the first generation without the draft. Without having to worry about life and death. And that was an interesting thing to me, and that like sort of turned the light bulb on for me a little bit. I was wondering what you, and you mentioned it, but how that impacts the way you look at the stuff we cover.
I think I mentioned in the book that like I just try to imagine trying to explain to my my grandparents who grew up in the Depression the fact that I waited in line for an hour and a half for a plastic Batmobile at Comic-Con. It's just like, I can't imagine it. They stole coal from like the sides of like the railroad. Like the coal cars would pass by and drop coal off, and they would go and scavenge to heat their house. And I'm dropping down, you know, entirely too much money for a piece of extruded plastic to kind of put next to my bed. I think there is there's something about the privilege of it. There's something about the idleness of it. The fact that we have the opportunity, the luxury of fixating on something from our childhood, you know, and not putting away the childish things that that my parents put away because they had to get onto the work of raising a family and getting out into the world and seeking their fortune. I mean, we're a bit more, my generation anyway, was a bit more coddled than the generation before, because they wanted to give us everything that they didn't have growing up, which means they gave us leisure time, and with leisure time comes things that fill it. And often in my case, the things that are most gratifying, the things that I gravitate towards, are the simple pleasures of childhood, and things like comics and action figures and these very colorful, and watching and rewatching old Spider-Man cartoons and Batman cartoons. You know, I certainly there are people in the military who served very bravely, who read comics and love this stuff as well. It's not necessarily, you can't, the reason I kind of touched on that and then kind of got away from that is pretty quickly is because I don't think you can, it's not a blanket statement. Mm-hmm. Obviously, cultures exist and have different causes, and they're caused by many different things all at once. And that's one factor, I think, but it's not the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say my dad is a 30-year Air Force veteran, and he, I think like part of it is comics are easy to take around. Like, and then also he definitely zoned into Batman because Batman has a second life. You know, my dad was mm-hmm. raising us in a house full of girls, and then he would steal away if he was stationed somewhere and did this, you know, violent, emotionally intense job and then had to return. So mm-hmm. I think like comics are very popular with soldiers. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They always had been. I mean, they were. We sent millions and millions of copies of comics over to the troops in World War II.
Yeah.
Because they were cheap and easily tradable. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, there's always been that very close relationship. I think.
I remember I was thinking about when you're talking about how would you explain to your grandparents that you were buying this Batmobile. I remember when Dunkirk came out. I went to go see it with my girlfriend, mm-hmm. and we watched it at one of those theaters where they have the reclining seats. And we like mm-hmm. brought it. We like snuck in food. We brought in like burgers or like sandwiches or something. Or I think it was we got salads. Actually, we got fucking salads. So we snuck in salads on this reclining seat and watching these kids who were like 18 to 25 just getting mowed down by Germans and like giving their whole life. And like my grandfather like lived in a foxhole for like a week on like the beach of Normandy or somewhere similar. During World mm-hmm. War II, and we looked at each other and we're like, what piece of shit we are. Like, I mean, we're lucky to be, we just appreciated that, like, you know, we were of, you know, we were 30-ish, so, like, 30 at the time, so, like, we could go and do this, and we were lucky that we would have to be overseas, but it was amazing, like, the difference in our lives, and, like, how could I possibly explain this to my grandfather who, you know, did that for, you know, fought for all that.
Mm. Well, that's it. I mean, they certainly would not begrudge you enjoying what you enjoy, but they would just assume that, you know, for something like Batman, that you would love that until you're age 12, and
right.
and you should put that stuff away. What are you doing? It's a different time.
That's funny.
Well, it's funny. I rediscovered Godzilla a few years ago, which I loved as a kid. And then something about mm-hmm. it, you know, it like re-triggered a few years ago, and I've like, gotten really into it. And there is that comfort of, I love this as a kid. You know, I mean, I understand it on a deeper level now that, like, it's political in a way that I didn't get as a kid. But certainly, there is that comfort of, oh, I watched this as a kid. I still like it. I can watch this over again and feel that sort of feeling I had back then.
Yep. For the book, I went back and tried to figure out what was the very first comic I ever bought. And so you can go and look on these online databases. And I found it. And that feeling, that rush you get is so powerful, but so ephemeral. Like, as soon, I know that if I were to seek it out and get it and look at it, I feel that same feeling. But as soon as I opened it up, that would just fade away. And I'm trying to write about this now. I'm trying to figure out exactly what it is that, where is the appeal there? What is it that we're, what are we reaching towards? Because anytime we, you know, I know that a lot of people, when they talk about this stuff, they say, well, it's just an escape from the everyday world. I go back to this stuff because it's escape. That's an answer, but it's not an explanation, because it tells you what you're running from. It doesn't tell you why you're running toward that thing. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What is it about that thing that is attracting you, that is calling you there? And so when you looked at the Godzilla stuff, I mean, do you remember, do you feel that same kind of palpable sense of, this is what it was like when I was a kid? Or are you enjoying it on a different level, as you say?
Well, I can appreciate, like, the, you know, there's political messages embedded in them that they got lost in translation, right? So I can appreciate that and enjoy it, finding that intellectually. But definitely I like, maybe not the ones from the 70s, because they're just so poorly made and campy. I can appreciate those and laugh with them. But even the ones from the 60s and the 90s, I like more than the newer, cool-looking ones. And I think that's partly because they evoke a feeling of, I was a kid back then, and I like seeing these miniature buildings getting toppled. And there's no real reason for that other than I enjoyed them as a kid. And like, also find it funny that there's a guy in a suit toppling, like expertly made miniatures, just really beautifully made. They just crush them.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm trying to figure out why this, like, watching old Godzilla movies where just plastic, you know, balsa wood Tokyo gets pummeled feels one way, and Men of Steel, which is still just this high fantasy, when you see Metropolis get decimated, or in Star Trek Into Darkness, when you see, what is it, San Francisco, future San Francisco, get just obliterated, that feels cheap to me. That feels like you are trading on 9/11 imagery to try to create this, to kind of poke the viewer with like this emotional response, like, mm-hmm. look, all these people are dying, isn't that terrible? And yet, because maybe it's that Uncanny Valley thing, right? Because the Tokyo of those old Godzilla films is so fake looking, looks so much like a railroad, like a toy railroad, right. that it you don't, yes, you see superimposed people running around screaming, but the notion of death isn't really in those films in a way. It's just fighting in rubber suits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's funny because I think about the guys who are making the digital cities now for these movies, and they're incredibly mm-hmm. well rendered and done and so realistic looking, but there is that Uncanny Valley, and to me, it's just a guy in, or several teams of people, because they're really hard to make, in a room making these digital graphics, and I admire the craftsmanship of it, but even just seeing something tangible, even as something really flimsy, get crushed, I think there's mm-hmm. something there. Not that I, like, cherish destruction or anything, but there's... But it also might... I think it's a large part of my childhood.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
What did you think of Ready Player One? I'm not sure if you saw it, but that is the old, that's like the pinnacle of nostalgia.
Yeah, I reviewed it for NPR, and ultimately that is not, it is a existential horror film, basically, yeah. because the notion that, because that stuff is from when I was a kid, right? That's all 80s stuff, that's exactly right. my wheelhouse. It involves this game called Adventure, which I played on the Atari 2600 millions and millions of times, and I knew the Easter egg that they were talking about. It's so speaking to me so directly that it's terrifying. The notion that somebody would still be caring about this stuff in 2046 is just sad. It's the saddest thing I can consider. So while it is Spielberg returning to this, you know, filmmaking is a roller coaster, is thrill ride, and that's fun. The idea behind it is so sad that I kind of came out of it thinking I think the movie understands that a little bit more than the book did, because
I agree, yeah.
you cast Mark Rylance and you as the guy who created this world, and you put him, you make that performance is tragic. That performance this is a man whose life is empty because he chose to go to this place instead of actually encountering the real world.
Yeah.
I don't think you get that to the same extent you get in the novel. I think the writer of the novel thinks that's awesome. Yep. And I don't get the sense that Spielberg does, at least to the same extent. So I don't know if I'd recommend it to people, especially if they're not in that wheelhouse. But it's always going to be weird seeing, you know, a teenager talking about Gundam or whatever. It's always going to be weird to me.
It was such a fantasy to be able to be like, wow, me knowing lots of geeky stuff is going to make me an actual hero.
I also think it just came out awkwardly with the IP they chose. Like, what kid that age boy cares about the Breakfast Club? Like, that's the poster that's on every 12-year-old girl's room. Like, not...
Yeah, that's true.
They were just throwing 80s stuff around, and I was like, I'm sorry, he does not care about 16 Candles or whatever, talking about those rom-coms.
There's also the interesting point that I think about, that this, he is, becomes obsessed with this, and I know in the book they talk about, like, he legitimately likes it, like, he loved watching Family Ties over and over again.
Yeah.
But he's also kind of forced to love it for survival and hope, right? Like, this kid is...
True.
And they're like... And so, like, it's a weird nostalgia, right? So, like, we love this stuff because we were kids when it happened. It gives us that feeling. Mm-hmm. He loves this because literally his life depends on it. Like, he could escape the horrible slum that he lives in by knowing just a little bit more about, I don't know, like, E.T. than someone else.
Right.
And I don't think the book really acknowledges that sad part about it, but it's also just something it makes you think about. I think about it a little bit.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
He Yeah, I agree. He made a good choice because he is a filmmaker. It's a mass market thing. Like in the book, you can have this extended part where they go into the Tomb of Horrors, the old D&D module. But if you try to do that on screen, that like only a sliver of your audience is going to know what the hell is going on there. So you transpose that with perhaps the most widely known locale in all of horror cinema, and all of a sudden this reference, which is such a narrow sliver, becomes this huge thing that allows people in a way. And that was a very canny, smart thing, because there is no saying that Spielberg isn't a master craftsman. Mm-hmm. So he knows how to get people. He knows how to get butts in seats and to thrill them.
Yeah, that Shining sequence was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to spoil it for people. But no, go. It's not yours.
No, I mean,
but it was. It was pretty great.
It was really, really awesome. And it was definitely one of those things where it felt like inherent. A lot of times the nostalgia in the movie didn't feel necessary for the story, you know, where like it was like being in a classroom that had a bunch of things that a teacher put up to try and relate to kids or something. Not that it was a classroom, it was a lot more fun than that. But, you know, like the there was decorations for the decoration's sake, but that felt really part of the actual story, which made it cool.
Yeah, I agree.
It was so I felt like I didn't love the movie, but I felt like the story was a little bit empty, but it made me reflect in a way that maybe Spielberg, like you said, kind of intended, but the author did not.
Ernest Cline.
Ernest Cline. Ultimately, like every bug of the book is basically turned into a feature because it is a very thin plot that's basically, it's fetch quests. It's a series of fetch quests, but the whole book, the whole movie is laid over this infrastructure of RPG games, right? So of course it's going to feel that way. So I can't begrudge the book. I can't begrudge the movie for being thin because the source material is thin, and it's intentionally thin because he's trying to recapture that feeling of an old school RPG.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to take obviously too much more of your time because you've been very generous with it, but I'm curious, when you mentioned that you think, and it makes sense, at some point superhero movies will decline in a way that every genre declines. Can you imagine a world, or do you think it'll be anytime soon, where geek culture is no longer in fashion the way it is now? Do you think it'll go back underground a little bit?
I don't know if we're ever going to go back to the days of jocks throwing geeks into lockers. I mean, that always is part of the rich human experience. But popularity is different now, and we now have nerds running the world. And I think something else is going to come along. I think I think there will be another way of expressing coolness besides knowing something or having a particular profound passion for it. Mm-hmm. I just think the world's too big, and I think human experience is too vast for this definition of cool to stay the definition of cool. Certainly in the 50s, it was greasers and who were cool. And then in the 60s, it was the hippies who were cool. And now it's the nerds. And, I don't think we're going to, I think the world only spins forward, and something's going to come along to change it.
Hmm. Emily, what's it going to be? What's the next cool thing?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I like take umbrance, I guess, with the idea that nerds are cool now. I don't think that's true. I think that storytellers are getting handed nerdy IPs, and then the stuff that they tell, those stories, are watched by a lot of people. But I feel like it has to be on levels, right? Like everyone has the nerdier friend who's whispering stuff to them at the Thor movie. You know, not everybody is that friend.
Eric, is what you're saying.
Right, yeah. Or a me. Like, I'm a me for a lot of people, where you're kind of like, you're past the point of uncomfortable, where it's like people will get down with cosplay in a way that they didn't maybe a decade ago. Mm-hmm. But if you're like role-playing on forums, that's still weird.
Okay.
That's it. Like, so I think stuff that happens on the internet, like, purely between people who have never met, that's never going to be mainstream. I feel like that is...
Yeah, that's true.
I suppose the nice thing, though, is that the mainstream doesn't really matter as much anymore because people can find their people.
Yeah, that's another good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, I guess... Yeah.
The way that we engage with this material, let's talk about superheroes. The way we engage with superhero stories has changed because of something like cosplay and fan fiction. It used to be the story got told, and then it kind of came down the mountain to us nerds, and we would not challenge it in any way. We would just simply take it and then pick it over and debate it like Talmudic study, where we would say, okay, so if it's established in this comic that Batman keeps a file on all these different characters, then he knows how to take each one of them down, which means X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And now fan fiction is about inserting yourself into the story, or inserting people who look like you into the story, or at least having a dialogue with this kind of storytelling. So yes, there's still people churning out, there's still creators churning out this information, but we are not simply accepting it. We are engaging with it in a fundamentally different way. And I think that changes, who we call ourselves. Do we call ourselves nerds or not? Once we start to take up these things that we love, could be superheroes, could be Doctor Who, could be anything, could be Star Wars, then the role of the creator changes and the role of the audience changes.
That's a good point. Yeah, I'm thinking of specifically James Gunn. Like, he's doing something I've never seen a director do before, where he's just constantly in conversation with people who watch these movies that came out, like, already they're a couple years old, and he gets on Twitter every day and talks about, like, you know, what he thinks the inner thoughts of a minor character are. It's not quite collaborative because he and the studio have final say, but I am surprised at how much wiggle room he'll give fans when they're talking to him.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like Mark Hamill, too. Like, he'll tell people about things. And, like, kids growing up in the 70s think that Mark Hamill, like Luke Skywalker, would directly correspond with them and tell them their theory was right or wrong, or giving them insight into, like, what Luke really was thinking. It must be mind-blowing.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Glenn, how can people get in touch with you on the internet and tell you their fan theories and other fun things about Superman and Batman?
Man, if they can shove it into, what is it, 240? Or no, it's 280. If they can shove it into 280 characters,
good luck.
They can do it on my Twitter, which is at GH Weldon.
Sweet. Emily, how can people tell you their theories?
I'm Emily G. Monster.
And she loves random people telling her fan theories.
Oh boy, do I know.
I'm at Jordan Zacharin, and you can follow the Phantom Files on Sci-Fi. It's on Twitter, sorry. The name is Phantom Files Sci-Fi, and so that's easy enough. Glenn, thanks so much for being here. This is really awesome talking to you.
Thank you.
This was so much fun talking to you guys. Thank you so much.